question for Jeff. Do you really think that necessarily the Spanish-American War represented a sea change, or was it simply a process whereby America became powerful enough to project power overseas? I mean, certainly if we look at the Mexican War, infiltrations of Americans into Texas and California, causing so-called, you know, separation movements, maybe really that was just part and parcel of a much longer term project of expansionism that we've been going through for the last 200 years.
Yeah, I think there is some truth to that way of looking at it. But I mean, there still is the critical distinction between continental expansion and overseas expansion. I mean, what you're suggesting is that if the U.S. hadn't had the opportunity for continental expansion, maybe it would have engaged in overseas expansion earlier, and that's quite possible. But I still, it does really represent a sea change in the role of the United States in the world. I also want to say something about Texas and California, because I don't. I think we need to make a distinction between governmental expansion and private expansion, and notice that at least initially, the Texas event was a kind of private expansion, and in fact, a lot of that's too strong a way to put it, but. There was an element of private expansion in the continental growth of the United States, right? In Texas, Americans moved in partially at the invitation of the Texas government and then got involved in a civil war within Mexico, which resulted in an independent republic. And I don't think that everything that occurred in the Texas Revolution can be justified from a libertarian standard, but on the other hand, I think that's in a different class than the outright conquest that took place in the Mexican War, and we need to be sensitive to these distinctions.
Mr. Thoreau spoke of the other nations opposing us. And President Bush came out with a comment after 9/11 that talking to the other nations that you're either with us or you're against us. And I think we know now where the other nations do stand. They are very much against us. And why is it that they are against us?
Do you have a question?
I'd like a response to it.
Okay. You have to make it short, though.
I'm the alpha male here in this room. I'm the alpha person in this room because I know best. And what are you thinking? Your reaction to that is very negative. But isn't that what we hear when George Bush makes a speech? I know best. I'm the alpha male. I hear that from him. And why are diplomatic efforts are received poorly and not working is because of that. And so as why they are not working, perhaps there's a fourth reason that they are not working, and that is our attitude toward them. And I think the four of you have given us some very strong evidence that we don't know best in this world. And our attitude when we deal with others, we do not know best.
If I could just make one quick thing that point that relates to the previous question is that, and this relates to the work of Bob Higgs that we keep on referring to. And one thing that Bob points out is with this crisis mongering, you create this sort of nationalization of authority in society. And the view that Jim was just talking about, the politician can't deny risk and pain and death that happens. And so the political leader is sort of a deification and sort of becomes this divine sort of Caesar-type figure that promises everything. And so it relates, I think, to this this question. Any panelists that want to respond? Ed?
Okay. Right on.
Okay.
I'm an alpha male, too.
This is for the general panel. Would you comment upon the intelligent function in this country? We're spending over $40 billion a year in apparently 16 different intelligent agencies to keep us safe. Mr. Close said that one of the items is maybe we're not as sophisticated as the rest of the world, we're not as knowledgeable as the rest of the world. Well, we're all busy. We're paying a lot of money into our intelligence agencies that apparently are not doing the job. And I would just like a comment from the panels where they see this thing going and how do we get better at this.
Carl?
I've read a little on this, and there's a great book out there by a former CIA analyst on the failure of strategic intelligence. And what he points out, he was at the CIA for a dozen years, and he talks about the culture of non-learning at the CIA. For example, PhDs, he was a PhD, and he knew of other PhDs who kept their education sort of hidden from their managers. We don't want Mr. Smarty Pants in here. We want a team player. Another example, they frowned on, or if you want to learn another language, you want to learn Pashtun or Farsi or something like that, do it on your own time. They didn't support acquisition of foreign language skills. They were also extremely paranoid about bringing into the agency people who've spent any time outside of the country, or the children of recent immigrants. So the culture there needs to change. There are a lot of other things that need to be done, first and foremost at the policy level. But even without those changes, it's really I don't know what the state now, but a brain dead bureaucracy.
I think it's a good question. Randolph Bourne said that war is the health of the state, and one could take the view that the government is just bumbling and not solving the problems that they could solve if they were smarter, or one might just take the view that it's not in their incentive to solve these problems, that the more conflict that they get us into and the more danger Americans see ourselves in, the more government is able to get away with numerous bad policies around the world.
Yeah, I think the question actually hints at one of the most powerful arguments in favor of non-intervention. You know, Hayek talks about a knowledge problem with respect to the domestic economy, and that's one of the reasons why central planning will always result in inefficiencies. And the international environment is exactly the same. It's not that, it's not that there's no way of improving the intelligence, because there's a certain level of uncertainty about the international realm. And as a result, it's not just that we know, in other words, I would never make the argument that foreign intervention is always going to have bad results for the United States. I don't have sufficient knowledge to say that. My argument rests on a more fundamental epistemic humility, which is I don't know, and the United States government doesn't know when foreign intervention will result in good outcomes versus bad outcomes. And even if I did know, I can't conceive of any incentive structure that would confine the U.S. government to interventions with good outcomes and prevent it from engaging in interventions with bad outcomes. And therefore, given the cost of intervention, the best policy is a hardline opposition to all foreign intervention.
One point that related exactly to what Jeff is saying is there's a certain sort of disconnect in the idea of central intelligence. In other words, the idea of central intelligence is that some government agency is going to be funded by taxes and is going to centrally plan some sort of intelligence gathering and analysis and then deciphering of what this is good for. And yet, this view of central planned information has been totally disputed in every other field of society. We don't do it with food, we don't with clothing, we don't do it with steel production, we don't do it with housing. Nobody really believes that that's a better way of operating. But for some reason, intelligence gathering has this view. And the irony of this is that an economy is a coordination system of people using information. And Jeff mentioned F.A. Hayek, the economist who talked about this, the fact that in a complex economy you have this decentralization of information and a process of discovery and competition in getting information to flow through people, in that no one has perfect knowledge of anything in society. In fact, everybody has a peculiar knowledge of their own circumstances, and that it's the interaction and peaceful exchange and coordination among people that makes a market economy more efficient than a centrally planned one. So right from the outset, the idea of a central intelligence agency itself is, in my opinion, a great hubristic view.
Let me do my turn here. And follow up what you're saying. You're absolutely correct that the problem is in intelligence. The speaker is correct that this is probably one of the biggest scandals in this country, that we have figures I've seen and calculated is we have 100,000 people in security intelligence of various kinds, diplomatic and so forth, which is a staggering army. And one of the big flaws in the whole operation is that it's secret. The thing about business coordination and economic coordination is it's public. That is, what you are charging and so forth is public knowledge. And the whole premise of intelligence in all the bureaucracies is that it's to be kept secret, even from the other bureaucracy, where it can't be challenged and tested and so forth. And the bureaucrats themselves know this. I had an occasion in an earlier phase of my life to hang around the State Department a great deal, and I'd be in there, and what were the officials in there reading? Well, it turns out we have this huge apparatus of political reporters in every embassy, and they're funneling this stuff, and it's coming in, and it's top secret, do not disturb, and so forth, cables. Well, on the desk of everybody in the State Department is the Washington Post and the New York Times. That's their information, which is not even tax-funded, but they depend on it more and more consistently than their own internal information that we pay billions for.
I was wondering what role embargoes play in a isolationist, non-interventionist policy, American policy specifically.
So one thing I might mention is the term isolationist needs to be clarified because...
Suppressed.
Yeah. Well, the term isolationist was invented, I guess, during World War I, right? It was basically used as a term to smear those that were critical of the intervention. And the view is that you were self-absorbed and not engaged in reality. And the popular notion of isolationism is linked with extreme protectionism, no trade, no travel, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, with that, who wants to?
I wanted to answer the question, but I need you to repeat it.
Well, what role does the embargo play?
Oh, yeah, really, really good question. Because it relates to American history. You know, Jefferson, although he didn't always adhere in practice to his ideals, was an advocate of non-intervention and peace. As a result, during his administration, when a British warship had fired on an American warship, killed several American sailors and seized sailors off the ship and impress them into the British Navy in what is known as the Chesapeake Leopard Affair. Jefferson was so determined to avoid war that he instead responded with an embargo, which turned out to be an economically disastrous policy. In other words, it's one of the most dramatic examples of misplaced idealism. In other words, his goals were peace, and yet the self-inflicted blockade that resulted from his embargo destroyed the New England economy, and he had to agree to its repeal before he left office. And I think that illustrates that trade restrictions, if they're, you know, I'm sympathetic to voluntary boycotts on the part of individuals, but I'm completely opposed to any kind of government trade restrictions, no matter what the rationale.
The follow-up question is, in the case of Japan and our refusal to sell them steel and oil so they could no longer continue building their evil empire, how is that a bad thing? You'd mentioned it was a provocation by FDR that got them to attack us.
Yeah, well, you answered your own question. It provoked the attack on Pearl Harbor.
How is refusing to trade
with someone involved in World War II? I can't think of a less desirable consequence.
How is refusing to trade with an evil empire a provocation?
Look, I think that you as an individual have a right to refuse to trade with anyone you consider evil, whether it's an empire or another individual. And you have a right to persuade other people to refuse to trade with empires or individuals that you consider evil. But when you cross the line and you use the power of the state to prevent me from trading with them because you haven't been able to convince me, I think that that policy is not only wrong, but incredibly impractical and counterproductive.
So embargoes don't always turn out the way they're planned. They often have unintended consequences. One rationale for Iran's nuclear program is to provide it with plentiful energy. Now, why would Iran, which has such huge oil reserves, need a nuclear program?
Global warming.
Well, aside from the fact that an inconvenient truth has been translated into Farsi, seriously, Iran has lots of crude oil. It doesn't have lots of gasoline refineries. And one reason is that it costs billions and billions of dollars to build gas refineries. The organizations, the companies that have the technical know-how to do that are forbidden by the sanctions. They're also, even without the sanctions at this point, they still might be quite skittish. But had we lifted the sanctions regime on Iran, and then Iran continued to build their nuclear energy program, at least then you might be able to say that their motives for the nuclear program are more transparent. As it is now, the sanctions both help motivate the nuclear program, and if they do have in mind the development of nuclear weapons, the sanctions regime helps give them cover.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask the panelists what they think is the proper response to 9/11. I gather from hearing some of the responses that they don't think intervention is a good strategy or response to the attack is in any way justified.
I think given the clear location of the attackers in Afghanistan, we had to do something about that. But I think it should not have been covered up with all this nation building, blah, blah, blah. You go in there, and they were out in 6 weeks, and they go home. Now, other things may develop from that. Maybe they'll be back in there and so forth. But then you take this policy of saying we can't control the whole world. The world is a dangerous place. If Al-Qaeda gets started up again there, let's see what they do. But again, I don't think, you know, politically we're back into that problem. Anything more, the Iraq thing was, of course, total irrelevance. Yeah.
I'm going to have to partially disagree with that answer. I think that non-intervention, by which I mean withdrawal of all U.S. troops from all bases abroad, elimination of all U.S. government military aid to foreign countries, all U.S. government economic aid to foreign countries, that was the proper policy before 9/11, and therefore it was the proper policy after 9/11. Now, it is true that 9/11 created a kind of dilemma where none of the options look good. But what's the reason that none of the options look good? Because of this history of U.S. government intervention. In other words, what's happened, Israel is in a similar situation where a consistent history of intervention has produced a situation where all of the short-run options have an unpleasant possible downside. And when you're in that situation, the best thing to do is to take a step back and eschew the mindless and counterproductive reliance on military intervention and have the courage to pursue the policy that will maximize the long-term prospects of peace and justice, and that is non-intervention.
I would say you have to vigorously pursue al-Qaeda, but you've got to do it in such a way that you don't recruit more into their ranks.
The proposal that we made after 9/11 was to have letters of mark and reprisal legalized, which, for those of you not familiar with this, in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, there's a portion where Congress can authorize so-called letters of mark. And letters of mark are essentially legalizing bonded agents, private agents, which then compete to go after some pirate or terrorist or whatever, and they get paid on a performance basis. But if they injure any other parties in the process, then they themselves can be viewed as targets. So the idea was basically, that's the way it's supposed to be, Jeff. The idea was that this would be a criminal justice response, in the best sense of that, which is targeted toward the specific individuals who are culpable for the deaths of the innocent people who died on 9/11, as opposed to, let me put it this way. The question is, what do aircraft carriers, stealth bombers, spy satellites, and anti-ballistic missiles have to do with combating people who carry box cutters or have a suitcase bomb? The answer is nothing. And unfortunately, the establishment in Washington is geared for the latter. The particular history of what happened was that we made this proposal. Congressman Ron Paul picked up on it. He had 10 other co-sponsors of a bill in Congress that would authorize this, and the bill didn't even suggest eliminating anything else, just to legalize this one thing. But the Iron Triangle of Washington shut it down, and it didn't go anywhere. Ironically enough, if you look at the actual success stories of capturing al-Qaeda, plus the Saddam family, et cetera, they were all done by private bounties. Any other questions?
Can I point out?
Yeah.
There is a bounty on bin Laden's head, and bin Laden is still alive and at large. There are bounties on other al-Qaeda leaders, and it's not... incentives work, but incentives don't always work, and monetary incentives are not always the best incentives. The people who are around bin Laden are loyalists, and they're not motivated by money, so I don't think that's sufficient.
Well, I would disagree with Carl, because the point is that, in fact, at this time, there was a group of high-tech business people who were putting together a billion-dollar bounty fund to get bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders, and that essentially is illegal now. Only government bounty is illegal now.
Well, if you take into account that the CIA and the ISA in Pakistan funded much of this. And then if you take into account the Saudi royal family backed bin Laden completely, we invaded the wrong countries.
We didn't invade any countries. The U.S. government invaded.
Well, we've been going on for quite a while, and I want to thank all of our speakers. If you'd join with me for a hand of applause. It's something of a challenge to have a forum that conveys the scope of the book that Carl and Bob Higgs have edited. So we hope that you'll get a copy, and I know that the authors here would be delighted to autograph copies for you. Remember, our next event is December 6th with Bob Higgs, and thank you for joining with us. Good night.